Welcome to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Cyber Monday. Have you shopped today? We are in the middle of it, but early projections for today were somewhere around $11 billion in sales, relatively flat from last year, according to Adobe Digital Insights. That after a lackluster Black Friday compared to last year, too. How important are today's digital sales for our economy here in the Commonwealth, and how are new technologies changing how we shop, how you shop, and how safely we shop? Let's start with Sucharita Kodali, Vice President and Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. Sucharita, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I'm curious, is this one where, like, we get early returns during the day and we know at 3 o'clock how Cyber Monday is going, or will we not know till reports later?
It pretty much is very telling, in large part because the best things are available early in the day and they sell out. And if they're not selling out now, they're probably not going to do that much better later in the day.
So how's it looking?
It's looking lackluster, as you had mentioned, and we felt that coming into the holiday. There were a few things that were happening. We have supply chain issues that were constraining even the amount of inventory that a lot of retailers had available. Some surveys that we did with retailers suggested that about a third of them were completely reducing the amount of promotions and offers they even had for Cyber Monday compared to last year. So if you don't even have the offers, you're definitely not going to see the sales either.
How important is it regionally? I mean, this is a global economy, especially when we're doing digital commerce. And yet you have to wonder if it affects the regional economy as well. Does the Commonwealth need it to be a good digital sales day today?
Well, the good thing is that the e-commerce and even retail is not made or broken on any single day. It can be nice if there is a huge boost in sales on a particular day. But the great thing is that the season is dependent on 60 days. It's not just 1 or 2 days that everything has to happen. We're not nearly as dependent on a single day the way that the Chinese retail economy is dependent on their version of Black Friday, which is called Singles Day, 11/11. In that case, it's almost 10 to 15% of all sales happen on that single day. So it's a problem if they don't make that day. In the case of the United States, there are so many other opportunities to make up that sales volume. And because we think that a large part of this flatness is due to inventory issues, we think that the inventory is actually going to come in later in the year. So we may actually have an opportunity to have some great sales in late December or even January.
So what kinds of products do you think will be strong this year? I guess we're wondering about gift cards since there are so many supply chain issues, but where else too?
Yeah, gift cards are definitely popular. That's always a safe bet. But it's often the same products that do best this time of year. It's a lot of technology goods, electronics. People buy TVs, mobile phones, tablets, anything that is in the electronics or tech space does particularly well. Apparel also tends to do particularly well this time of year. You'll often have home goods like appliances, small appliances like, you know, tabletop appliances. It could be like an air fryer or an Instant Pot. Those kinds of things do very well this time of year, too.
And in general, do you expect just sales in general flat compared to last year? That seems to be the story so far. Or are you expecting a healthy overall, let's say it's spread over 8 weeks this time, a healthy overall holiday shopping economy?
More flat than doing particularly better than last year. E-commerce will do disproportionately better. That's where there has been a lot of energy through the pandemic. There are a couple of other things that are unique to this year. One is that inflation is also higher in part because of the supply chain issues, but also due to money supply issues. And when you have high inflation, you're not going to have as much of an appetite for consumers to spend. And now, you know, we just learned there's the Omicron variant too. And there are the Omicron. I've always been mispronouncing that. But that's also creating anxiety for shoppers as well. In a best case scenario, about a fifth of consumers are nervous about going into stores. This was before this variant. Now with this variant, you can only bet that that number is going to go higher.
All right. Well, we will continue to watch for that. That is Sucharita Kodaly, Vice President and Principal Analyst at Forrester Research. Sucharita, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's turn for more now to Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter for the Boston Globe, a regular here on Radio Boston. Hiawatha, welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here.
So let me just start by asking for your reactions to what we just heard from Sucharita.
Well, yeah, sounds pretty plausible to me. I've been hearing about shortages of electronics and stuff. Not, it's not necessarily that things aren't out there, but in some cases you're going to have to pay substantially more than you might have in previous years for things like laptop computers and the like. And of course, you know, this is really interesting. Remember last year when everybody was dying to get the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox, the new Xbox? They're still dying to get them. They can't get them. They're gone. Nobody can find them. And by this time, 1 year into the cycle for a new console, shortages should be much less of a problem, and they're not. The chip issue has really continued to dog anything electronic. And by the way, of course, that has spilled over into countless other things. You know about cars, also home appliances, all kinds of stuff that you might ordinarily want to buy is going to be in short supply because of chips. And on the other hand, as you point out, sales are, well, we don't depend as much on one big day in the United States. And Americans just buy all the time. So I'm not really sure. I personally think that Black Friday and Cyber Monday are as big a deal as some people make them out to be, because it's always Cyber Monday in America.
So, you know, I do wonder about that, Hiawatha, especially as people can begin to shop in new ways. I noticed, for example, that Walmart teamed up with Twitter to do a live shopping event on Twitter yesterday, which I got to say, as a sort of a layperson, just looks like taking the home shopping network to
Twitter.
Yeah,
I saw that too, and I'm with you on that. I'm not really sure I see why anyone would want to do that, but then I didn't understand the home shopping network. And here we are, what, like 30 years later, and it's huge. People love it. So I don't see any reason why it won't work on Twitter too.
And so we'll probably continue, I'm assuming, then, to see new ways on new social media platforms that people can purchase to do the security.
You know what I'm waiting for? The Clubhouse shopping network. Remember when the year began, there was this big buzz about the social network Clubhouse with people just talking in this constant party line? I haven't heard anybody finding a way to shop on that, and it sort of petered out. People got bored with it. It hasn't really caught on.
It would be interesting, though, for party line shopping. That could be pretty interesting. So listen, Hiawatha, in the time that we have remaining, let's talk a little bit about risks when you shop online. I mean, there are risks even when you hand your credit card to someone that you might experience fraud. But what do you watch for with digital shopping, and what should people pay attention to?
Well, you know, the obvious thing is that you shop at reputable retailers. I mean, that's one of the advantages Amazon has. You go to Amazon, you know that you may not like the product you got, but you can trust that you are almost certainly not going to get hacked while you're on the Amazon website or the Walmart website or the Wayfair website. There are a lot of smaller, lesser-known online retailers out there, and well, you have to be a little bit more careful shopping at places like that. I don't want to discourage people from shopping at the little guy, but you do have to take extra care, like maybe do Google searches and find out whether these guys have a good reputation before you want to do business with a retailer you haven't heard of before. So that's always going to be a problem.
And are there better or worse ways to pay, Hiawatha?
Oh, personally, I don't know. When I'm out on the out in the real world, and believe it or not, I do go out in the real world, I usually end up using Google Pay or Apple Pay, because I actually feel more secure using the phone-based payment systems than I do with plastic. Although, you know, plastic isn't that dangerous either, but I like waving my phone over the terminal. The big worry I have is when I pull into the drive-in line at the Dunkies, I have to hand them my phone so they can do it themselves. That makes me nervous. But yes, these phone-based systems like Apple Pay and Google Pay are actually quite secure, and I feel much safer using them.
Are there other ways to think about paying that you should or shouldn't do, like over the telephone or, you know, passwords, using passwords and keeping track of the 8 million you're supposed to have versus that temptation to use one?
Oh, well, that's a different issue. That's keeping your password safe. I'm a big fan of password managers, too. I do, like, banking and shopping and all kinds of stuff on my phone. And one of the reasons I do it is because I use a password manager that is locked with my fingerprint. And so in order to put the password into any of the apps I'm using, it's stored in this device. And so I can use the most insanely complex passwords you ever heard of. Password managers are a great idea. I think everybody should use them, but with one crucial warning. Each of them has a central master password. And if that master password falls into the wrong hands, so do all of your other passwords. So you have to be very careful about that. But the best thing about password managers is that you can then give each account an insanely complicated password, and more importantly, you give each account a different password. You know how everybody uses the same password on everything?
Yes.
No, don't do that. Never do that.
But then protect the password to your passwords.
You have to. You write it down someplace, you put it where nobody else can find it, and you never let yourself forget it and change it on a regular basis. Absolutely.
Any other advice or things you are watching, Hiawatha?
Well, yeah, obviously. Yeah, most of this is stuff everybody should know how to do anyway. Like if you get messages via email from any of these companies that, you know, the Amazons, the Facebooks, et cetera, be very careful about clicking any link that you receive inside a mail that came from somebody you're not sure who they are. The best thing to do if you get a message saying, we're Facebook and we're warning you that something's going on with your account, don't click anything in that email. Go directly to Facebook and go to your account and see if there's any information there waiting for you. Do not click on the link in one of those emails because it could be a phishing email. Just don't trust any email from somebody you don't know who it came from.
All right. That is Hiawatha Bray, technology reporter at the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, good to talk to you. Thanks for being on the show.
Always a lot of fun.
A bill that would mandate teaching the Holocaust sits on Governor Baker's desk, waiting his signature. The legislation would require middle and high school students to learn about the Holocaust and about genocide. State Senator Michael Rodrigues, chair of the Senate Ways and Means Committee and sponsor of the Senate version of the bill, says such teaching is crucial for our future.
There's still so much hate in this world and so much misinformation, and it was just important that we teach the younger generation about the genocides that have happened and occurred over the years, hopefully to prevent them from ever happening again.
Now, while the governor hasn't signed the bill, he has signaled his intention to do so. So let's look at what led to the bill and what could change in our schools as a result. Join the conversation. Do you want Governor Baker to sign the bill? Should the state mandate such teaching? Do you wish you'd learned more about genocide, human rights, when you were in school? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Joining us now, Nima Avashia, who is an eighth grade history and civics teacher in the Boston Public Schools, and Chris Moriello, head of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Salem State University. Nima, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chris, I'm actually going to start with you. This bill would mandate education on the Holocaust and genocide in all of middle and high schools. This seems late, is it?
Well, Massachusetts is a bit late. I think it's around 19 other states have similar mandates for Holocaust and genocide education. However, it's essential that we begin the process of making this curriculum available to all of our students. And as I've said to others, the Holocaust and Genocide Education Bill is not merely about commemoration or memory or never forget. It is actually essential to civic education and to our democracy. So I agree with the representative that the hate that is happening in our society is not only historical, but it's also contemporary.
Chris, you used the word essential twice in that answer. Why is this mandate essential?
Well, the mandate is essential because the curriculum is crowded with a lot of material to cover. And I'm speaking specifically about a social studies curriculum. By this bill being front and center, it provides our teachers and our curriculum directors with an opportunity to integrate human rights into the curriculum in the middle and high school. And human rights education is just central to understanding not only, again, what happened in the past in terms of comparative genocide, slavery, atrocities in the past, but I think it's a conversation that many students want to have and many teachers need for have with their students for a framework for this discussion. And I think moving forward, that is what's essential. This provides a framework for understanding themes that our students and our teachers need and want to talk about.
Nima, you teach eighth grade. Are you talking about genocide, about human rights now? I don't mean now, this week. I mean now before this mandate.
So I think we definitely talk about the the genocides that have happened on our own continent, when it comes to the genocide of indigenous people, when it comes to racial terror lynchings that happened to African Americans in the last 400 years. Like, we talk about those ideas in the context of the class that I teach. I would say those aren't things that are explicit in the standards for my course. Those are things that I, as a teacher, kind of think are important and thinking about how to work in. When you think about the actual standards for history and social studies in Massachusetts, it's a 217-page document for K-12 history standards, and the word genocide appears 9 times. The word Holocaust appears 9 times. Both of those words are only appearing in the standards for World History II and U.S. History II, which students take in their later years of high school. So as it currently stands, there is not, prior to 10th or 11th grade, there's no space in the standards that's really clearly stating that this is content that young people should be learning about and grappling with in their classes.
And do you feel young people you teach are at a stage of maturity where they're ready to be learning about it and grappling with it, Nima?
Yeah, 100%. I think adolescents want to understand what is unjust about the world and want to understand what to do about it. I think a lot of the time we are, you know, we're more scared to have those conversations with them, but like, they're actually very ready. And the reality is they're seeing everything. Social media makes it so that young people are seeing everything. So if we don't give them ways to make meaning of what they're seeing, we're actually doing them a disservice. I think about like the spike in sort of anti-Semitic language that we've seen and that we've seen reported on. And it's like, that's coming from somewhere. Young people are learning those things. They're acquiring that information, right? But are we actually making space in school to make sure they have the right understandings to make meaning of those things when they see them? Or are they just sort of acquiring and accumulating symbols and language without having the history to understand the implications of what is being presented to them?
So there's a lot there that I'd like to unpack. I do want to add a couple caller voices, 800-423-8255, to join this conversation. Megan is on the line in Watertown. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi, I think this is really important because it provides students with a foundation that they can use to combat a lot of the misinformation that is out and about today on these that are so prevalent still in our society.
Thank you for that call, Megan. I'd like to go to Todd, too, in Holden. Todd, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So my family has distant relatives, grandparents that were lost in the Holocaust. And I learned about it as a kid just because of that. So I've known about it my whole life. I would say majority of people are nowhere near educated about it as they should be. And when I heard that teacher say that it's not part of her curriculum, but she does it anyways, I think that's, first of all, wonderful. I think we need more teachers to kind of not buck the system, but at least teach what we feel is necessary for our kids to know. So, having said that, it is totally essential to make it part of the curriculum. So people have, teachers have to teach it. And there has to be real concrete discussions about it.
Thanks, Todd.
Even need to go deeper into slavery.
Thank you, Todd. I appreciate it. So, Chris, I'm going to turn back to you here. Listening to Todd, listening to Nima, I'm thinking of an English teacher I had in high school who used to always say that structure breeds freedom. And I wonder if you can talk about, if the governor signs this mandate, what does it allow, right? We tend to think of mandates as what does it require, but also what does it allow teachers to do? Maybe you can talk a little bit about both of those things.
Good. Idea of what it allows teachers. What it allows teachers to do is in a structured way is to develop students' understanding of issues of democracy that get corrupted or destroyed prior to any mass atrocity, many type of genocide. So what it does is I think it sets up an opportunity for teachers to weave into the middle and high school curriculum some major themes of democracy, of othering, of racism and prejudice, which of course are at the root of mass atrocities such as the Holocaust or the Armenian genocide. So for me, I see it as an opportunity for teachers to really think through how can we interweave this in the curriculum so we're not just pulling out disparate moments in the past, but we are talking about themes of civics and democracy that are essential for having these kind of grounded conversations.
And I, you know, wholly agree with the idea that students are ready to talk about this, whether they're getting the information from somewhere else, they're bringing it into our classrooms and they're talking about it. If they have a structure to understand it, then I think it's a lot more productive conversation. And I think everyone will be more comfortable in having those conversations.
So let's stay on that thread. And Nima, I'm going to play some sound for you. We spoke with Jeremy Burns about this. He is the executive director of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston. There had been criticism of this bill that you don't need to mandate something if it's already being talked about in schools. He responded to the criticism by pointing to what happened with the football team at Duxbury High School when they used anti-Semitic play calls during their games.
This is a community that has had a Holocaust and genocide education component in its curriculum, but it wasn't mandatory, and not every student learned it, and not every student appreciated it, and clearly it was not part of the culture of the school for many, many years, and that has to change.
It makes me think of both what Chris was just saying and your comment earlier, Nima, about young people are being exposed. Do they know what to do with it? Do they know what they're encountering? Do they understand that history? Are they culturally prepared to address it? What can happen? What will happen in your classroom now, Nima, if this mandate is signed to help students grapple with that?
I think that what has to happen is it can't be that we add another 15 pages to the 217-page document. I think what we have to do is get really clear about the sort of like core understandings that we want young people to have over the course of their K-12 education. And one of those really core understandings is like what happens when we dehumanize people, and what happens when we dehumanize them in the United States, what happens when they've been dehumanized in Germany, what happens when they're dehumanized during the Armenian genocide. Like, that core theme is something that I think young people can actually start talking about and thinking about when they're quite young. You don't have to get into the details of genocide with a very small kid for them to understand what it means when we stop treating people like they're human beings. Young people see that happen all the time. And so I think for me, what it could allow, or if we let it, is for us to clarify sort of what are the most important things that we really believe young people need to walk away from our education system with, and how do we pare down, and how do we make sure that the things that are most important to us are the things that we are coming back to again and again over a young person's education. So I think it's an opportunity to clarify and call if we use it as such. I think if we just tack on an addendum to the standards and say, do this too, I think that will have missed the point.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. So, Chris, first to you. You met with school officials in Duxbury after the anti-Semitism was documented. Will this kind of mandate, will the teaching that will happen in classrooms, does it stop a future incident like Duxbury?
Well, just to clarify, I didn't meet with school officials, but I was part of a workshop that was sponsored by the Lappin Foundation at Duxbury High School with a group of students who engaged this topic of the Holocaust and Holocaust education, and then visited the museum in Washington, D.C. So what I learned from that conversation is that, you know, the students that I was talking to were clearly really engaged on this issue, had studied it in detail. And what the Duxbury incident with the football team, what it showed them is that their community and their school was not approaching this topic in a serious enough way. And they wanted to draw attention to that. And I was amazed and really impressed with the students' ability to handle the concepts. These were high school students, handled the concepts of comparative genocide studies and some of the themes that we talked about with the students. Yes, dehumanization, but it's also the concept of the breakdown of democracy. Before genocides and the mass atrocities is this sense of a breakdown of social order, where some people do not have recourse to the law, where the state becomes an oppressor, and when the governmental system breaks down and the party system breaks down. It's not that long ago, we can think about it in our own country, and you know, just this year, of a moment in which the breakdown of order, and we saw it firsthand. So to me, it is the Duxbury students were impressive because they wanted to take control of the situation. They wanted to have input into the situation. And I was really impressed that they were able to to have this workshop. Whether it makes a difference, that's a community decision. And I think this genocide bill really does give teachers a set of resources and tools and understandings and hopefully some professional development that they can bring this into their curriculum from K through 12. So students, all students can have this conversation as good as the one that I had in Duxbury.
So Nima, one of the things that's echoing in the back of my mind is concerns from parents that there are so many boxes that have to be checked in curriculum as it is, so many things that have to be taught, and they have to be taught in a certain way so that there's an assessment test, so that there's performance against standardized tests like the MCAS, for example. Talk about adding another requirement into the curricular mix here, how you react to that as a teacher, what you think those trade-offs are. And I guess I also wonder whether this is a subject that can be parsed out in that way.
So, I mean, I think that actually that is the thing I've been thinking about the most, which is the way in which 20 years of high-stakes testing has resulted in a narrowing of our curriculum so that this isn't content that young people are getting in the same way that they were previously. When I first started teaching 20 years ago, like, young people were reading books like Number of the Stars and Night in school, and some people still are, but lots aren't, right? Because standardized testing has pushed people to move to reading one-off articles to be able to find the main idea and the supporting details, as opposed to really engaging deeply with literature and literature that reveals, like, the human experience. So I think there is a big question to ask here that I think people don't like to ask, but about how the decisions and choices that we've made around making our curriculum more and more narrow to match with standardized tests has actually done a real disservice to our young people, and whether that's something we should continue to do.
Let's go to the phones here.
Go ahead.
Thanks. 800-423-8255. We have a Nima. Nima on the line in Cambridge. Go ahead.
Yes. I am African American and Native American, and I can't tell you how difficult it was for me integrating predominantly white schools and not learning anything about the contributions of Native Americans and African Americans to this country. And especially here in Boston area, there have been so many people who contributed not only to the different legal
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Nima, but it feels like where you're going is both contributions and history around indigenous peoples, African Americans in the country, enslaved peoples. Is that where you're going?
Genocide. Well, there was genocide as well, and children need to know this.
Thank you. Thanks, Nima. I'm gonna bring it to Chris now. I appreciate your call, especially you rooting it in your personal experience. And Chris, the bill has something to say about this, which is why I was anxious to bring it back to you.
Yeah, I mean, if you read the entire bill, the bill is a Holocaust and Genocide Education Act, but it also includes those key moments in American history, Native American removal, and westward expansion, as well as slavery. And this goes back to something I was saying earlier about introducing these themes of who has recourse to the law, how do democracies operate, who gets left out of the democratic process, who gets left out of the ideals of citizenship. So you can talk about issues ranging from Native American history to slavery to contemporary issues of immigration. And what I think is nice about the bill, and what I think is opening up for teachers, is that it provides an opportunity to talk about these issues in a more integrated way. And I completely sympathize with anyone who is worried about kind of layering and keep layering the curriculum. But if this bill can do anything, it can really provide an opening very early in a student's career to understand some of these basic concepts, so they'll have a set of concepts and tools when they approach the 20th century and want to talk about explicitly about the Holocaust or about the
Cambodian genocide. They'll have a set of a framework of tools, of key terms, of understandings of human behavior and governmental behavior that they'll be able to plug these back into.
Let's get a quick student caller voice, and Maria's on the line in East Boston. Go ahead, Maria.
Hi there. So I went to Arlington High School, actually, and it was 10 years ago now, but I did take my senior year a human genocides class, where we would read books from survivors of genocides and then talk as a class about the impact that has on our society as a whole. And as someone who took this class and found it really valuable, my friends now that I talk to wish that they had a similar class. So I'm absolutely in favor of this legislature passing.
Good to have the testimonial. Thanks, Maria. So Nima, what's the homework assignment? What's the reading assignment? How does a young person begin to engage with this content? How does that learning happen? What's the lesson plan?
Well, it's definitely not one lesson plan. I think, you know, I do think this, we're talking about really deep learning, and I really think literature is a big part of it. So one question I would ask are, what are the books? What are the things that we're going to read together? Like, are we reading Night together? Are we looking at kind of connecting back to what this last caller said? Like, how are we using the testimonies and literature that are connected to these time periods to support our understanding of the human experience? I think that Facing History in Ourselves is a really great organization that's done a lot of work around this. They have a whole Holocaust and human behavior curriculum that they've created that is taught in some schools. But again, it's often an elective that some students take as a junior and senior. I think there are a lot of existing resources that we could turn to and look at and think about how we are going to sort of embed those in students' learning experiences over a very long arc of their education. But it definitely is not the kind of thing where you do a one lesson and be like, check, we talked about the Armenian genocide. If we want it to stick, it needs to be deep, and it needs to be that we're thinking about entire curriculum units that are really centered on understanding these sort of the patterns that we understand around genocide, how it happened, what the impacts are, what the legacies are. We're talking about pretty significant bodies of learning that would need to happen in classrooms.
Nima, these are hard subjects. These are hard. Any trepidation as a teacher, any heart palpitations or sweaty palms about teaching these challenging subjects?
It is really hard, and actually it makes me think back to the caller previously, where I think part of what I was hearing her say is, like, how do we hold the pain in balance with also the joy and contribution?
Nima from Cambridge,
and I think we
yeah.
Yes. You know, I think we have to do both. Like, I think it's really important if we're going to teach the history of genocide, but we also teach the resistance that existed against each of those genocides, because there was always resistance. And so that's a really important framing that I hope that we're holding, and that I hope that in our classrooms that the focus is on, yes, like, here is the atrocity, and also, like, here are all of the people who are standing up in 100 different ways to try to figure out how to stop it. That part is going to be really important. If we don't do that, I think it is a lot of pain. But I think there's a lot for young people to learn in understanding how there have always been people who've resisted, and how that gives us the tools to think about resistance in our own lives.
Following on that, Chris, message to parents who are anxious about turning over teaching of a subject so painful and so intimate, and for some so close to their lived experience, their family's history, over to the classroom teacher. Message to them.
My message to parents is that this is something that is on our students' minds. They see it online. They see it in the news. They hear about it from friends. It is something that is definitely painful to learn about. I think the classroom becomes a place for them to understand it on a deeper level. What is going on? why these things happen. And one thing I've, whether the students are in college or in high school, the idea of fighting against the idea of inevitability in history. History is the decisions that people make. It is the context that they live in. It is the who was the perpetrator, who was the victim, how complicated is the gray zone between those things sometimes. And this type of learning to me is such a powerful, because it's emotional, because you're connected to it, because you can put yourself in the place of the victim or in the place of, in other cases, the perpetrator or the context that they're in, deciding what you would do and why you would do it. And I think that that type of emotional learning is powerful. It stays with students throughout their years. And I think this would provide teachers a framework in which to do it in a way that is, I think, reasonable, that is controlled, and that there's support there for them. So for parents, I think that's an important message, that this, if teachers are trained well and working with professional development and resources that do it well, there'll be a support system for the teachers and for the students.
All right. Chris Moriello is head of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Salem State University. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
And Nima Avashia is an 8th grade history and civics teacher in the Boston Public Schools. Nima, good to have you back again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Finally today, we want to remember Phil Saviano. He was the founder of the New England chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He died on Sunday at 69 after a battle with gallbladder cancer, according to his brother and caregiver, Jim Saviano.
He faced threats because of the work he was doing. People shunned him in this town, for example, and he marched on because he had the right motive.
You see, Phil Saviano was the whistleblower who played a pivotal role in exposing decades of predatory assaults by Roman Catholic priests in the United States. What happened to Phil as a child is difficult to hear about, so this next segment may not be appropriate for all listeners. Today, to remember Saviano, we wanted to bring you a conversation he had with us on Radio Boston back in November of 2015 as part of our series on the movie Spotlight, the multiple Oscar-winning film which tells the story of the Boston Globe's 2002 investigation of what later became the worldwide clergy sex abuse crisis.
I was 11 and three quarters, and it was the spring of 1964.
That's Phil Saviano in 2015, speaking with then-Radio Boston host Meghna Chakrabarty, describing the exact moment he first met Father David Hawley.
Well, I was the newspaper boy, and I also lived just up the street from the rectory. I had to drop the newspaper off 6 days a week, and on Fridays I had to knock on the back door of the rectory to collect my 60 cents for the week. He took an interest in several of us, and slowly drew us in with funny stories, card tricks, things that a 11 or 12-year-old boy would find fairly interesting. And then one day, the deck of cards that he pulled out of his pants had pornographic pictures on them. And the effect of that was that, first of all, yeah, we thought that this was pretty unusual, but we also felt like he was sharing a secret with us, drawing us in, making us feel even more special. And so it was a sort of a gradual process that ultimately ended up in him exposing himself to us. And very shortly after that, coming on to us rather forcefully and asking for masturbation and oral sex. And I can tell you that I could not figure out how to get out of it, because what I was able to do was say to him, I don't want to do this. I can't stay. I'm going to be late for supper. I have to get back to my paper route. And his response would be to grab me by my skinny wrist and pull me closer. And I did not have it within myself to go screaming out of the church. The difficulty for me was that I was dealing with a priest who right. I saw as God's representative at our little town.
There is a heart-rending scene in the Spotlight movie where Phil meets with the Globe's reporters and he asks them, How do you say no to God? This wasn't just sexual abuse, he says. It was also spiritual abuse.
I was trying to figure out whether it was sinful. And if it was a priest that was doing this to me, maybe it wasn't sinful. But on the other hand, if it was sinful, I really ought to confess it, because if I got run over by the school bus, I'd be in big trouble.
But you'd have to confess it to the man who was doing it to you.
But I had to figure out a way to confess it to Father Hawley, because he was my confessor. My abuser was my confessor.
But Saviano says he would go to church, enter the confessional, and sit in the dark, closing his eyes, knowing Father Hawley was inches away on the other side of the screen. Saviano would begin his confession.
Whatever my sins were as a 12-year-old, I yelled at my mother, or, I don't know, I lied to my brother, and then I would say, and you know the rest. And never, not once, did he question me and say, what are you talking about?
Phil, may I say that this was 1965, you said?
Yeah, 65. 64 and 65.
So 50 years ago now.
Yeah.
And you still remember it with such devastating clarity.
I remember it, and sitting here, it's close to bringing tears to my eyes. That's how much I remember. It was a huge dilemma. Well, but fortunately, after 18 months, he left town. And none of us kids, at least, knew what happened.
Phil Saviano spent decades believing he and a small group of children were Hawley's only victims. He was wrong. Almost 30 years later, Saviano was 40 years old when he saw a small story in the Globe's Metro section about a pedophile priest in New Mexico. It was Father David Hawley.
And the day that I saw that story was my big life-changing moment, because I realized that my assumptions had been very naive. And then I also realized that this guy had a very long career. I mean, there were victims in Texas. There were in Texas as well as New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then he was eventually assigned to a diocese in Denver, Colorado, which is where he was when these stories came out.
Phil Saviano went to New Mexico and tracked down one of the other victims. That meeting changed his life. The man urged Saviano to speak out, telling him he had the rare chance to help dozens or even hundreds of people he might never meet. Because there was also this.
I was dying of AIDS, to be honest with you. The early part of 1992, I was very, very sick. I had had age-related pneumonia. I lost 30 pounds. I had, at that point, bought myself a cemetery plot, and I was interviewing funeral directors, trying to see who was going to do the best job with the makeup, and just, you know, making plans to check out. So I said to myself, how much harder can going public be than what I've already been going through? Mm. I mean, I'm dying. My career was in shambles. I was completely broke. At that point, I'd been living on disability for several months. And in the eyes of many people, you know, being a gay man with AIDS, my reputation was pretty shot. And I realized that I didn't have anything left to lose.
So in 1993, Phil Saviano went public. His story appeared on the front page of the Boston Globe and later on USA Today and in other media. He and other survivors then asked the church to pay for their therapy expenses, but they were rebuffed because the church claimed no one had ever made any complaints against Father Hawley. So Saviano, through his lawyer Eric McLeish, sued the church.
And over the course of discovery, I learned that there were 7 bishops in 4 states that knew he was a child molester, that he had been caught repeatedly, that he had been sent to 4 different church-run treatment centers. You know, the deal with these church-run treatment centers is that they're not mandated reporters. Mm-hmm. So the secret gets kept within the organization, and Father Hawley was very much protected through that process.
The church made Saviano a settlement offer, but it included a strict confidentiality agreement.
Basically, I said, what, are you nuts? I'm not going to, there's no way I'm going to agree to this. If I was to go along with that, I would be no better than some of these bishops who were covering it up. And I, you know, I said to my lawyer, I'm not taking these secrets with me to the grave. I'm not having that on my conscience that I cooperated with the church in their campaign of secrecy.
Eventually, the church backed off from the confidentiality demand. Saviano says it's probably because everyone figured he was dying of AIDS and wouldn't be around to trouble them for much longer. But Saviano proved them wrong. This was 1996, and a couple of remarkable things happened. First, the FDA had recently approved the first protease inhibitors, powerful AIDS drugs that saved Saviano's life. Second, he founded the New England chapter of SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, and he started meeting people, collecting names and documents.
And I approached the Globe in 1998 with much of what I had. I sent them a four-page letter, a pile of the documents from the Father Hawley case with letters from bishops in different parts of the country. I thought sure that the Globe reporters would be interested in looking into this, and much to my surprise, they weren't.
And to the filmmaker's credit, that oversight gets a mention in the Spotlight movie.
John Slattery, in this one section of the film, and he says, 5 years ago, Saviano was a frigging train wreck. No, we didn't miss anything. And I think that he was sort of covering for himself in the fact that, yeah, they did miss a lot of stuff. And if they had paid proper attention to me, they would have had this story several years earlier.
The Globe Spotlight team did eventually listen to Saviano. They spoke with him for hours. His story and contacts contributed significantly to their Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting in 2002. Seeing his story on the big screen in 2015 in the movie Spotlight, he told Meghna Chakrabarty that it made him cry. And then she asked him this.
Are you still a Catholic?
You know, I do have that cemetery plot in the Catholic cemetery back home, and I will probably end up there. But I'm not a practicing Catholic. I've learned too much about the Catholic Church to really take it seriously.
Phil Saviano, speaking to Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty in 2015. Phil was the founder of the New England chapter of the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. He died yesterday at age 69 of gallbladder cancer. And again, his brother and caregiver, Jim Saviano.
His greatest influence was in changing the church to self-examine itself and begin the process of correction. And that resulted in a lot of lives being spared what he had to go through.
That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.